Everyone, it's Thursday, February 27th. Lucky you, you're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Wet out there. It's raining out there. Those April showers. Oh, wait, it's February. I can't sing that song. We have, a really wonderful show today, and I'm excited about that. But, of course, as we begin our show every day, we begin with the voice of Colonel Vindman. As he testified before Congress, you will have committed it to memory by the time the show is over because it will not end until November of 2020 with the election of perhaps the next president of the United States. And, of course, you got to hear President Trump yesterday talking about COVID-19. I know a lot about the stock market. Anyway, Colonel Vindman, in his own voice, assuring his father, it will be all right. Which we all collectively know it will not.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Colonel Vindman begins our show every single day between now and the November election of 2020. Unfortunately, Colonel Vindman, he will not be all right. We will not be all right. The country will not be all right. Frankly, the planet will not be all right. Things need to change. Things need to change. All right, everyone. So I am actually excited about this interview because we did a lot of homework in anticipation of it. Of course, that's what I do. And joining us right now on the line from the oldest paper I have read from the time I was a child, the Christian Science Monitor. And Mark Trumbull is the economy editor. He's reported from the Monitor from both the U.S. coast while maintaining ties to the Midwest where he grew up. Mark, my father would read me two newspapers. Instead of reading me fairy tale books, instead of reading me children's stories, my father would read to me from the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor when I was a kid. I am 66 years old. What should that tell you about my life? Oy vey. So the Monitor has been such an important part. And the reason why I think he read us the Monitor, especially years and years ago, it was probably the best place for international news anywhere on the planet. So I learned a lot about not just my country, but I learned a lot about my world. So I value it. And even though there's such challenge for journalists all over the world, the Christian Science Monitor is still struggling to sort of sustain itself. And I am so glad that you are part of the conversation. How long have you been working for the Christian Science Monitor?
Well, yeah, since about 1987,
wow.
Actually.
Wow.
So, yeah, a good long time, and we appreciate faithful readers like yourself who,
yep.
We're trying to hold that, be one of the institutions holding that banner of
yep.
strong and kind of journalism that can point towards solutions.
Well, exactly.
Hopefully.
Exactly. And again, I'm glad I asked you how long you've been doing this since 1987 for the Monitor, because again, you have institutional memory. And one of the things that's so valuable is not just investigative reporters, which we're finding, you know, there are little places that are popping up like ProPublica and Public Integrity where people are investigating, but people like you that are writing for the Monitor that have been doing this for such a long period of time. So let me tell you, no surprise, why your story caught my attention. And I will tell you about all the homework I did in anticipation of this. Your piece was, "Should You Exist? Billionaires Face Rising Criticism Alongside Rising Power. In a capitalist society, money more than talks, but in an age of rising inequality, some Americans are wondering whether there is such a thing as being too wealthy." So, Mark, I've done a couple of things. And one thing that I want to sort of share with my audience, they've heard me say this before, but I will lay the foundation for you, Mark, is that when Hillary Clinton was running for president after she had been the Secretary of State, she took a hiatus before she did her formal announcement. After leaving state, I think it was about a 15-month hiatus, and then she announced that she was running for president. In that 15-month period, she raised for her personal bank account, I believe, about $21 million. This is not for running for president. This is for Bill and Hill and their kids and grandkids. And at the time that she was raising that $21 million, I think she and Bill were probably one of the rich ex-presidents we've ever had. So they had made lots of money after he left somewhat penniless because of all the lawsuits from the White House. But they had amassed significant wealth. And I was really angry at her. And I know Bill and Hillary because I ran with them for governor in 92, and I ran with them when I ran for Congress in 96. And one of the questions I wanted to ask Hillary Clinton, which is why she never appeared on the radio with me despite my location in Concord, New Hampshire, was I wanted to ask the question of her, and maybe this is the question of all the billionaires, when are you rich enough? And Mark, yeah. I don't know if you have the capacity to do that someday, but I would love to have you reach out to the Bill Gateses and the Bloombergs and the Bezoses and everybody else who's amassed, you know, incredible wealth. They're not just billionaires. They're billionaires on steroids. When are you rich enough? And when does it become really not about wealth, but really about amassing influence and power, which is really what this is about? Because with each extra billion, your ability to influence outcomes and influence power, I'm sure, is enhanced. And then one other thing, and then we have to get into your article. So I said to Stephanie, who was working with me, I said, Stephanie, my husband who died was a math guy. He loved numbers. And he realized that most people didn't quite comprehend what the numbers really meant. I mean, we throw the term millionaire and billionaire and trillions, but nobody knows what that number is. They can't even wrap their head around it. You know, billionaires can because they count their chits. But most of us will never get to that point. So we found an interesting way of describing for the American people what exactly it means to be a billionaire. You ready? So here we go, Mark. If you were earning $45,000 a year, now, the average household income in America today is 63. That's household. That could be one person, two people, three people, but household. That's the median, not even the average. The median household income is 63,000. But let's say you were making the vast majority of that 63 and you're making 45,000 a year. Ready for this? It would take you 22,000 years to earn $1 billion. 22,000 years. Now, I don't know what drug you're on that you could live that long, but most of us are probably going to croak at around 85, you know, and maybe if we're lucky, 90. I think that is a number that, frankly, if you're going to be angry at billionaires, it's not just angry at them, but to recognize the amount of wealth we're talking about is something that you will never be able to envision. Because if you have to work $22,000 a year at $45,000, it means that it's not within your capacity, and it never will be. And so I wanted to start there, and then let's get into your article, because I think it's a worthwhile article, because we have seen not only the number of billionaires increase significantly in the United States, but I also did one more thing, and then I will throw it to you. I looked at the number of billionaires in the United States from 2007 to 2012, all right? The number of billionaires was 415 billionaires in 07, 469 billionaires in 08, A precipitous drop after the economic meltdown to 359. Oh, my God. They only dropped a couple of billion. A couple of billionaires we lost because of the economic downturn. But that don't worry about them. They came back, not the rest of us. By 2010, there were 403. By 2011, there were 413. By 2012, they were basically back up to normal at 425. So what's the number of billionaires today in the United States? The number varies depending on where I looked. It was anywhere from 609 to 621. They didn't just come back. They came roaring back. And I think these numbers and that $45,000 a year is an important way to lay a foundation for our conversation. Because unless you know that, we're throwing numbers around that have no meaning. And they don't even have meaning when it means what's happening to the rest of the economy and the rest of us. So talk to us about your article and about what you discovered as you were writing about, you know, should billionaires even exist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for that context to set it up. And I think my article was premised, first of all, on the Democratic debate, not the most recent one, but the prior one in Nevada. Where the presidential candidates had some discussion over this because billionaire Mike Bloomberg was for the first time on the debate stage.
Right.
He came in for some criticism on this issue. He was asked because rival candidate Bernie Sanders has commented billionaires should not exist and proposed a tax plan on wealth to try to work toward that idea. So Bloomberg was asked, should you exist? He said, essentially, I worked hard for that money. I earned it, and I'm giving it away. He added that. And that goes to an interesting potential answer that may be emerging to this question, because you say, how much is too much? Well, in a sense, a lot of billionaires are answering that question through this thing called the giving pledge, where they're increasingly, or many of them at least, have begun to say, I'm going to give 90% of my wealth away to charity.
Right.
It's almost a tacit admission that at a certain point, there's no reason why one person should have that much money. Now, not all of them are taking that pledge, and even though some who do aren't giving their money away real quickly.
So let me just say something about Bloomberg's answer. So I heard that, okay? And so I thought I would do a little homework about Michael Bloomberg. And what was so interesting about Michael, I'm learning too much about billionaires and making my head spin. So what I learned about Michael Bloomberg was that when he bought his race for mayor in New York, spending more per capita than anyone had ever spent in the history of New York City to acquire his Republican mayoral seat, because he became a Republican in order to buy the Republican primary and then to buy his seat, he had a billionaire status of $5 billion. Now, he was mayor for 12 years. Now, I don't know what you earn as mayor, but I'm sure it's not in the billions. I'm sure it's not even close to that. And today he has $62 billion. So, I mean, that was from 2012 to 2020, he's like, how hard did he work? I'm just trying to figure out how hard was he working in 2002, and tell me how much harder he is working in 2020 that we can jump from five. Has anyone ever asked these guys the question, how much harder are you working today to explain to me why you are, $58 billion richer today? And you know what? I think, Mark, I don't know. I know you're maybe not in the position to do it, but nobody asks those kind of stupid questions, but they're really important questions. I do work hard. I work harder. And usually when I work harder, it means I have to take on a third job. It usually means that I have to, like, instead of hiring someone to mow my lawn, I have to mow my lawn myself. Or instead of hiring someone to paint my house, I have to paint my lawn. I know what working harder is. I'm trying to figure out what do billionaires mean when they say they're working harder.
Yeah. Well, and interestingly, one of the rejoinders to his comment was, well, a lot of your workers worked hard. Sanders brought that up. it was not just you who got that money, pulled that money together.
Yeah.
And the other thing, Bloomberg himself said, I've been lucky. And whether you call it luck or good fortune or whatever, probably any of these people who make it that wealthy do it by some combination of talent, vision,
and luck.
Luck along with the helpers they have.
Right.
And among that, as the people like Sanders who are proposing a wealth tax note, the business successes that people have are built on a foundation of a society that has a government, and where the government is setting up laws and infrastructure and education systems that kind of allow business to then take root and grow.
So as I've been thinking about this, so if the idea is that if they're doing wildly successfully, then you would assume that I know that the idea was, you know, that you would lift all boats, and apparently the only boat that's going up is the yacht. Okay, the rest of us are in dinghies and we're sort of still waiting. You know, we're waiting for an oar, let alone like to rise up. But the other thing that's so interesting, and this is where I would love to be able to sort of talk to billionaires, and I'm sure you talked to a lot of people as you wrote this article, was that in the 1940s there was a 90% chance that you would do better than your parents if you were born in 1940. By the 1980s, it had plummeted to 50%. And I can't imagine what the number is today in the 2020s. So as they're doing successful, do they have any sense other than the giving pledge that maybe they're getting has taken away so much from the vibrancy of their country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, the interesting thing is some do, and I think at least, you know, whether they've come up with the policy answers to how to rectify that, they at least see that something is wrong. You know, and at least a fair number of very wealthy people are donating to the Democratic Party, or even running for election,
right? Or buying the Democratic Party. I mean, I don't know if they're donating as much as they're acquiring.
Okay. Well, and that's an interesting part of the debate. But just to finish the thought, I mean, they're, you know, that is the party that is more concerned about income inequality as something that Washington policy, federal policy, should be doing something about right now. And some are in a group called the Patriotic Millionaires. I haven't heard of Patriotic Billionaires being another group on top of that. But people who say tax us more because things have just gotten out of whack. The other thing to note, though, is, of course, I think it's important just to, as context for this discussion, there's a big debate going on within the Democratic Party about as you try to address this growing inequality and try to help the vast majority have a better chance of upward mobility, how do you do that? And is it the Bernie Sanders set of policies, or could those in some cases kill the goose that's laying the golden egg? Now, the golden egg of capitalism, so to speak, hasn't been so golden lately for a lot of people.
Right.
But there's worry that if you tax billionaires out of existence, the very policies you use to do that, even if your goal is not to kill capitalism or job growth, that it could, that there is a kind of process by which capital investment forms
leave
around good ideas,
right.
And if you don't let those ideas prosper, the whole society is going to be poorer.
OECD looked at this incredible gap in wealth, and what they suggested was that because of this wide wealth gap, that actually the GDP per capita of the United States was probably lost about 5%. because of the gap. So as we're talking about if we kill the billionaires, what will happen? Well, the billionaires are killing the economy. So no, everyone assumes billionaires are good for an economy, not bad for an economy. And Mark, as I've been doing too much work. This is making me crazy. And so I decided to look at the democratic socialist, you know, compassionate capitalist countries that Bernie constantly refers to. Now, the Nordic model, the Swedes, the Norwegians, the Finns. And I found out that, believe it or not, there are more billionaires per capita in Sweden than there are in the United States. Right.
Yes. So I saw that same number. I couldn't believe it.
But you see, what bothers me about the conversation we hear during the debates, you know, of the 2020 candidates is these numbers. Like, I want to do the math. I miss Andrew Yang in a bit because I want to do the math. And the math tells an interesting story. Well, wait a minute. Sweden has an amazing safety net. You don't have to worry about going to debt when you go to college. You know, when you get sick, you don't have to worry about whether you have a copay or out of network. You go to a doctor when you're sick. And yet they have successful capitalism because they have more billionaires in Sweden per capita than we do in the United States. So the fiction that somehow if you invest in all of us, it means you can't be wildly successful turns out to be a lie. But I think here's the problem is that do you want to just be a billionaire? Or do you want to have $100 billion? Is it about billions or is it about 62 billion, 100 billion, 98 billion? Because being a billionaire ain't enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are very good questions that society needs to wrestle with. And it really does. As you know, a lot of the biggest billionaires happen to be in the tech industry, which is changing all of our lives, you know, in many ways, arguably for the better. But there's a lot of risks to be managed. And then I'm going back to your Hillary Clinton example at the beginning. Even when these people are giving vast sums to charity, there's the question, is that the way society... How much is that benefiting society? Arguably, it's good to have more philanthropy out there in just causes. But, you know, you can have billionaires competing with each other from opposite ends of the same issue, working at cross purposes in charity.
That's right. I'll give to the American Heritage Foundation. I'll give to, you know, think of the dueling nonprofits, one with one policy agenda and the other with the other, but both of them are giving their money away.
Yeah. And then influencing the political debate in a big way, sometimes very obvious, sometimes not so obvious. I mean, I was interested to learn... it probably was clear at the time, but looking back, I mean, the foundation of a lot of our think tanks of all political stripes came from philanthropy.
Right.
There's an important role, even if you accept the need for philanthropy as a positive augmentation to what government can do. There's a role for the general public to be kind of watchdogs on, what policy needs to do to manage our collective resources.
So here's the thing. I think that the idea of philanthropy to supplement what government does is a good thing. To supplant what government does is a lie. Mm. And the giving pledge is interesting to me because here's what I would like to see the giving pledge do. Give back to the federal, state, and local coffers. Because when you give back to those, then you really are investing in your country, in your state, and in your community. But when you pick and choose who you want to give back to, I may want to give back to Harvard. I want to maybe give back to Johns Hopkins. I may want to give back to the Lincoln Center. Well, that's well and good. But you know how often I go to the Lincoln Center? I don't even have a center in my community. You know how often I'm going to go to Harvard? I was there, I think, once when I was a visiting fellow after I lost my race for Congress. And it was a couple of months, okay? So I just want people to understand that that's part of the giving pledge is that there's also a fiction there. Because the fiction of the giving pledge is they get to not only choose what floats their boat in the way they want to be philanthropic, But the other thing, Mark, is can you also remind my audience, you get to write what you give off your federal tax liability. That giving also comes with a draining of the actual revenues we need to run a country or a state.
Right. Yeah. Very, very important points. And, I think the, there's the good that say, a group like the Gates Foundation can do. They have a lot of money to spread, but it's hard to know the best uses of that money.
Exactly.
The charitable giving can be very creative. It can try new things.
Right.
It can prove out an idea, but ultimately, if an idea is a good one, arguably it should be adopted then for wider,
everyone. Exactly.
For everyone in a more organized way where it's not one billionaire calling the shots.
So here's my dream. My dream is I want to get a group of billionaires in a room, maybe 10 or 15 of them, and I want to sit and I want to ask all these questions of them. And then I want it to be advertised and put on TV and put on the radio. And I want me to ask the questions and I want to hear their answers. Because that's the problem. There's also a money moat around billionaires. We've even seen it around Michael Bloomberg. And you can't always swim the moat. You can't always get access to the billionaires. And they're uncomfortable with those questions because I'm not sure they either want to answer it or that they want us to hear the answer. And I think that's part of the problem. Your piece at the Christian Science Monitor, Should You Exist? Billionaires Face Rising Criticism Alongside Rising Power. Thank you so much, Mark, for writing this piece. Mark Trumbull writes for the Christian Science Monitor since 1987. Wow. Take care. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Good to talk.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day that 27 Japanese women working in the Seattle public school system handed in their forced resignations. In the aftermath of the attacks on Pearl Harbor, anti-Japanese hysteria swept the United States, especially the West Coast. 127,000 people of Japanese ancestry were sent to live in 10 internment camps by executive order of President Roosevelt. Many of these U.S. citizens sold their homes and businesses, often for a fraction of their value, before they were forced to move. In Seattle, mothers from Gatewood Elementary School circulated a petition for the removal of Japanese office employees from the schools. The school district pressured the women to resign. Even James Sakamoto, the editor of the Japanese American Courier, encouraged the women to voluntarily leave their jobs. He met with the women at the newspaper's office and told them they should resign before they were fired. Faced with such pressure, the women wrote a resignation letter. They wrote, "Most of us have received our education in local schools and have been proud of the fact, as we have been proud of our positions as employees." Word of the resignations quickly became headline news in local newspapers. Several protests were held in support of the women. Students at the University of Washington circulated a petition on their behalf. They gathered more than 1,000 signatures, declaring the treatment of these office workers undemocratic, intolerant, disrespectful of the rights of American citizens. In 1986, the governor of Washington signed into law an admission of wrongdoing toward these women and payment of reparations for their forced resignations. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Last year, Hurricane Dorian struck the Bahamas with wind speeds of more than 180 miles an hour. It was the strongest landfalling Atlantic hurricane on record, and it came during the fourth year in a row with above-normal hurricane activity.
I really don't think it's an exception. I think we're moving towards hurricane seasons that will be more and more like these, where the extreme, the stronger storms are getting stronger.
Astrid Caldas of the Union of Concerned Scientists says research indicates that warming oceans provide more fuel for storms. That can make hurricanes more intense. And it's not only that wind speeds are increasing. The warming atmosphere can hold more water vapor, so more rain can fall during a single storm. In the case of Dorian,
it stalled. It stayed over the Bahamas for a long period of time, dumping rain and creating damage. And there have been studies showing that the stalling of hurricanes is kind of a global trend.
Caldas says that until the world reduces global warming, the trend towards strong, devastating hurricanes is likely to continue. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Well, a doctor comes round here with his face so bright, and he says in a little while he'll be all right. But all he gives is a humbug pill, a dose of dope and a great big bill. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times in me? Mighty high times right here. And what happened to you poor black folks? Well, it just ain't fair. He took a look around, gave a little pep talk, said I'm with you, then he took a little walk. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times?
All right, everyone, we are back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. How can a poor man stand such times as these? The great, the phenomenal Bruce Springsteen. Even I know who this is. I am so damn culturally challenged. Well, the person who can address how can a poor man stand such times as these, as well as the opposite of the poor man, a guy by the name of Michael Bloomberg, who is running for president, is our next guest. He joins us on a regular basis. And if you happen to be turning on Democracy Now! On Wednesday, you got to hear the melodious tones of Bob Henley as he was on Democracy Now! Talking to Amy Goodman about Michael Bloomberg and sort of the misinformation that Michael Bloomberg was offering regarding things like, of course, I've always showed my tax returns. For the 12 years I was mayor, I showed my tax returns. And I'm screaming at the TV going, liar, liar, pants on fire. And of course, not only did I say that, but you have the tape and the receipts because you covered Michael Bloomberg from the time he became the mayor of New York. And every year you knocked on that show me your tax return door. And guess what? It never showed up. Welcome to the program.
Wow. Thank you. That's a great introduction.
Well, it was a great interview, and I couldn't stop smiling. But, you know, it's I always feel like that's what the rich people do. You don't need to know this detail. You're the little people. You know, this isn't important for you. It's too complicated anyway. You know, it's like, just trust me. And I'm thinking, right, why would I trust you when we're seeing the greatest gap between rich and poor? And, you know, you came roaring back after 2008 and I got screwed. So trusting you hasn't done anything to benefit my family, my children, and my future. So, you know, even if we're starting with just the basics, like show me your tax return, I think it speaks volumes about sort of the rest of their agenda.
Well, I think that if we go back and actually look at what happened, just to reprise, I mean, I know you have great loyal listeners, but they might have missed an episode when we last tuned into As the Billionaire Turns.
Right.
There was this ritual here in New York City over on Third Avenue where reporters would go, intrepid reporters, bored reporters, frustrated reporters, to Michael Bloomberg's accountant, Geller Co., and there, up high atop Third Avenue, would be the mayor's press handler, Stu Attack Dog Lozier, and he would hand out, not for us to copy, take with us, or in any way deface or mar, copies of heavily redacted versions of Michael Bloomberg's income tax.
Redacted, and, everyone. Remember the term redacted. That means blacked out. Go on.
Well, and now, though, but it was pleasant in the sense that what you did have was not just blank spaces, but letters of the alphabet. So the common people, A through G, stood for numerical values. And G was equivalent to, I guess, if I remember correctly, $500,000 or more. So you're looking at page after page of G, Of course, the charitable giving was described in glowing detail without a missing decimal point. However, how he made his money, what he paid in taxes, well, that remained relatively obscure.
Wow. That, I was looking at your piece that you had written about this, and then I was Googling, you know, taxes and Michael Bloomberg, and even the Wall Street Journal said it in like 2019. He never did. He never did. So it's not just a bunch of lefty progressive writers or people who care. It's the Wall Street Journal that was equally frustrated. And we just had a conversation with a reporter from the Christian Science Monitor. And the conversation was, you know, should billionaires even exist? And I'm going to share this number because I think we really do need to give people a sense of what it means to be a billionaire in America. And Stephanie, I love you, because Stephanie found something so remarkable that really gives people, I think I need to use a statistic every day, just the way I start with Colonel Vindman. Maybe I'm going to end with this stat. If you were earning, listen to this, we just shared this in the first half of the show. If you were earning $45,000 a year, okay, now that's, you know, that a lot of people in America don't even make $45,000 a year. But anyway, if you were earning $45,000 a year, it would take you 22,000 years to earn $1 billion. 22,000 years to earn $1 billion. And I think part of what gets Michael Bloomberg some sort of a safety net, or gets Mark Steyer's, you know, Tom Steyer's a safety net, or Bezos, is that we're using numbers like, you know, 62 billion, and we know what 62 is, but we don't know what billion is. We hear the term 100 billion. We know what 100 is, but we don't know what billion is. But if Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or, frankly, anybody up there told that number to the American people, that if you were earning $45,000 a year, it would take you 22,000 years to get to a billion, people would be devastated because they've never understood what it means to be a billionaire.
I think that one of the things that we need to kind of remind folks when we talk about this kind of macro data is that it's not just like they say, you know, the relative comparison when they say something like five billionaires. I think Oxfam had a number that the five richest people had the equivalent mm-hmm. of some huge number percentage of the entire Earth population.
Yeah.
It's important to know that most people, say 40%, of households in the United States, according to that Marxist front organization known as the Federal Reserve, say that people couldn't scrape together $400 without borrowing something,
right.
Borrowing money.
Right.
So in essence, what the reality is that Americans are deep in debt, and we're experiencing this exponential increase in wealth concentration and income disparity. And so as a consequence, there has been a body blow to America in a way that is we're aware of, and we're made to feel ashamed about it because we're in isolation. Because, of course, based on television, everyone is going on a Viking cruise. Everyone has a new Mercedes.
Yeah,
you
right.
Poor person have fallen behind. Your grown children are living
you
in
the basement.
You
can't afford a Jaguar
exactly.
for $465 a month? Come on.
Exactly. And so it's only through programs like this and Democracy Now! And other kinds of direct communications and movements and campaigns that we begin to share our miserable circumstance. And in that miserable circumstance is power.
Yeah.
And so if you come to understand that, you know, the fact that we now are in a situation where, like, let's look at, like, basic things. If you just take the label off the United States and just look at it as just a nation, a bunch of people hanging out, how would we judge it? We would judge it by, well, what's the average life expectancy doing? How is that doing? Well, 3 out of the last 4 years, the United States, it's declined. Okay, so how is Brand X Nation doing when it comes to young people wanting to procreate and making their parents proud? Well, it's a declining birth rate. Well, that's not good, is it? Especially if your entire social contract for old people relies on what?
Young people.
Your children.
That's
or immigrants,
right.
And we know we don't want that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, and so as we're talking about this, I do think that you mentioned that Federal Reserve number, that 40% of Americans, if there was an emergency, don't have $400 to respond to that emergency. Now, I'm going to translate that into President Trump giving that talk yesterday about COVID-19. COVID-19 is an emergency. It hasn't happened yet. But here's the problem. If you can't go to work, that means you will not see income. And if you can't scrape together $400 for an emergency, COVID-19 is an emergency. because you still have to take care of your kids. You still have to pay the rent. You still have to make the car payment.
Right.
But if you're told not to come to work for a week or not to come to work for 2 weeks, guess what? 40% of the American people could not handle it, could not handle it.
By the way, that abbreviated use of the disease, that's a.k.a. coronavirus.
Yes.
Are the cool kids saying the way you say it now?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, because it's very important. We're just talking about that here in City Hall, about it's important we keep using the same word to describe it from
right.
a public health standpoint. But I think you raise an interesting point. And, you know, I remember now coronavirus is something that, well, you know, crises happen. But let's talk about the impact of a self-inflicted crisis by Donald Trump, which was, remember, the government shutdown.
Right.
That was the same situation
exactly.
where hundreds of thousands of civil servants who have steady jobs all of a sudden found themselves in crisis. Who are these people that were in crisis? They're the people that are the corrections officers at the federal facilities, and
right.
they make like $47,000, $48,000. And so if you go 35 days without a paycheck, and you're driving, say, because you can't afford, if you're guarding people in New York City, you certainly can't afford to live here. Mayor Mike saw to that when he turned New York City into a luxury good. So you're driving yourself west of the Delaware all the way to Pennsylvania to lay your poor, tired head down. President Trump decides you shouldn't go to work. Now you have a crisis. You're on a food line, and you have to make sure on the way home you stop at the food pantry after guarding violent criminals.
So, you know, I think this is so, we got to tell this story. And the reason, so Bob, talk about the shutdown. Because take the shutdown and then put it on steroids. Because that's exactly what may happen with coronavirus, COVID-19, whatever you want to call it. Because they're talking about how will schools respond? Will they shut down? And let's remember that what happens when a school shuts down. For a high school, it may not be as big a deal. But for an elementary school, it's going to be a wicked big a deal. Because
right.
children cannot be latchkey kids when they're seven. That means that you may have daycare for after school. You may be able to drop them off at 7 o'clock. What do you do between 7 and 5 when you have to go to work and your kids are now home, not on a vacation that you planned for, but on an unplanned vacation where they're home? And so, you know, I think nobody has sort of played it out. And I think what you just said about shutting down the government is so interesting because we saw it happening on a micro scale as opposed
right.
to what it would mean on a macro scale. And as someone said, and the daycare may be shut down as well. So, you know, you're going to have to keep them home in place. And I think we need to make that analogy. And the other reason is that when I was talking about tax policy, when I was running for governor, I had my hair cut. And this guy was saying to me, I'll never vote for you. I don't want increased taxes, yada, yada, yada. He was bitching and moaning about taxes. So then I said to him, so we started to make small talk. I needed to deflect away from the politics. I said, so how's your kid doing? Oh, she's graduating from college. Really, how's she doing? God, I hope she gets a job working for the state. I almost kicked him in the groin. I went, excuse me? You want her to work for where? He goes, oh, yeah, she'll have a stable income. She'll have good benefits. She'll know the time she'll have off. I said, did you just hear what you just said to me? You hate me because I'm trying to stabilize the revenues for my state. So the daughter that you want graduating from college can actually get a job with a good pay and, you know, stable benefits and a good vacation. Did you realize what you just said in a matter of like 10 minutes? This is the problem, Bob. Nobody gets it.
Well, I think that one of the things, well, clearly somebody is, because people on television, on corporate media, are very agitated.
Yes.
Have you noticed?
Very agitated.
Yeah, so something's getting done here. One of the things about this is that what this brings up, any kind of challenge at home, any crisis, is a lack of redundancy. What do I mean by that? I mean just a little bit of bandwidth, a little investment in community health care,
exactly.
a little investment to make sure that children are cared for. But what's been going on for an awfully long time, both Democrat and Republican, is turning America into a mean, lean, global competitive machine. And the thing about that is what you have is we reduce the amount of money in the public sector. We demonize teachers. We demonize civil servants. We play them off against each other.
Exactly.
Cops against firefighters.
Wisconsin.
Exactly.
They played the cops off against the teachers.
Right,
it was brilliant strategy.
The Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan mythopoetic is by downsizing and shrinking government to the absolute minimum footprint, the great wealth will be empowered to make the world better.
So,
and it doesn't happen. And that's what we're living through.
Well, so we talk a lot about Michael Bloomberg, but you know, I'm not sure whether he
we
is
went
going,
5 minutes without talking about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We did go 5 minutes. Thank God. But in a way, we were sort of implying Michael Bloomberg. So one of the rationales Michael Bloomberg, you know, used for stepping into this race was that he was there to rescue the Democratic Party in case Joe Biden couldn't carry us over the finish line, whatever that means. And now I'm listening to cable news, and I'm listening to sort of the Bloomberg outlet, which is MSNBC. And it really is the Bloomberg outlet, everyone. I want people to know that. When you look at some of the people that are hosting the shows, when you look at their economic analysts on the shows,
right,
you have to start asking, who did they work for before coming on MSNBC? And it turns out they worked for Michael Bloomberg. So
right,
it's very important that this is the Bloomberg news outlet, the way Trump has Fox News. All right, this is really
right,
what it is. So one of the rationales now is, well, it looks like Joe Biden might survive the South Carolina primary. He might even do well. We don't know yet. It's not till Saturday. And if that's the case, no problem, Michael, disappear. Now, I don't know about you, but one, I don't think he's getting out, number one. And number two, they have been propping up and holding up and rehabilitating and giving crutches to Joe Biden to get him to South Carolina. What would make you think that someone who has to be so massaged and goes into occupational therapy and physical therapy to ultimately become the candidate, is that the candidate that you think could take us over the line? Or do you think that's the candidate that would basically say to all the billionaires, not a problem, I'm with you, so make sure I win this race? Is there a wink and a nod going on here that I just don't see?
I think there is a the way politics is covered is kind of like a black box. And so the people receiving the most amount of money for this skill of discussing extemporaneously the issues of the day that we're doing right now,
right,
are entirely disconnected from the actual circumstance of the misery in the rest of the world. And this is something that's very important. And so they are inside a black box talking about a pinball machine called politics.
Right.
It is devoid of actual any reflection on the circumstances of living, breathing humans, and that's very important.
Yeah.
And this is what happened to 2016, which is why they didn't see the big tilt called Donald Trump.
Right.
And why didn't they see the big tilt to their pinball machine? Because in the rest of the flyover states, and we've covered this ground here, in places like Cleveland, there were 6,000 vacant homes because President Obama, as graceful and kind as he is to individuals, he took care of Wall Street and let MLK Boulevard and Main Street hang. And
right,
so African Americans lost their homes in record numbers. Main Street imploded. And you can go see it today. You can still, if you want to take some time, next time you're in the area, we'll go to Newark, Irvington. You pick your city. It's still there. And I don't see any NBC trucks there. I don't see anybody at the sheriff's sale. It's a hidden part of America. And that's why they miss the wave of what's coming.
Well, you know, I was going through these numbers with Mark Trumbull of the Christian Science Monitor about the number of billionaires. And what was so interesting was that I went from 2007 to 2012. Okay? And from 2007 to 2012, the number of billionaires ranged around 400 billionaires in the United States.
Right.
There was a drop, however, in 2009, right after the economic meltdown.
Right.
They dropped to 359, just in case you know the number. But they dropped right back up in the next year because we bailed out Wall Street and the billionaires came roaring back. So we made the billionaires whole. What was so shocking to me, however, was the number of billionaires ranged around 450 people. By today, in 2020, there are around 620 billionaires. So
right,
in a matter of the same period, an eight-year period, we were ranging around the 400 mark, and all of a sudden today, we're at the over 600 mark. And I don't know how we can do this, but I do think that math matters. And I think if Trump was so successful, he played to people's fears. But I think one of the ways to sort of be an antidote to that is to give people the numbers and the facts and say, right. You know what? His solution basically massages those billionaires and makes more of them and doesn't fix you.
Right, right. As a matter of fact, that $1.7 trillion tax cut accelerated wealth inequality. And I had a chance to have an exchange with the Orange One when up at Trump Tower on this very topic when he talked about how he was going to bring back all this money by coming up with a new tax structure, because we knew that major American corporations were doing the unpatriotic act of stashing $2 trillion offshore. And so he was telling me that this was going to just bring back the money and going to create all kinds of economic opportunity. And this had been done back in the early 2000s by Bush. And what happened was they paid themselves huge bonuses and did the three-card Monty stock buyback, which is the thing where they buy the stock back. They don't invent anything new, and they just gin up demand for it by creating, you know, it's like when you're with a kid and you make bubbles. That's what they do. They make bubbles. That's what they specialize in. Right. And the consequences, when the bubbles are gone, is for us to deal with. And I wanted to, we've gone a few minutes without mentioning Michael Bloomberg, but it's essential to talk about the Bloomberg LP enterprise and about how it is that that's really been the driver of this globalization of great wealth, because it's based on these nifty little terminals that you have, computer terminals that have proprietary data bases that are ability to tell you the real-time prices for exotic instruments you probably shouldn't be selling anyway, and you can move them in and out of the Cayman Islands before anybody knows. And you've got your Bloomberg terminal, and everybody who's smart, all the venture capitalists, the vulture capitalists, have these terminals, and it permits them to move their great fortunes around the world while migrants are having a hard time getting by the border and worrying about their kids being put in cages.
Right.
That's where we are.
Right. No, it is quite remarkable. And we interviewed Matt Stoller the other day, who wrote an amazing piece at Wired magazine. And his piece was really about the fact that the coronavirus or COVID-19, whatever you want to call it, is really going to challenge what he called sort of the affluence generation, the idea that we don't have wealth, we have affluence. And there's a difference between wealth and affluence. And the thing that I think is so fascinating is that the way people were so wildly successful was that they shipped our jobs overseas. And with those jobs, we got jobs. We just got jobs. I remember in the 1970s when we saw the beginning of the leaving of the manufacturing jobs.
Right.
And I remember giving a speech in the 1980s. And I said, you know, here's the problem. You had the women's movement happen in 1970, and you have the beginning of outsourcing and the removal of jobs to places like Vietnam and China. I said, and it was perfect for the women's movement because women were knocking the door going, I want to get into the workforce. I want to be treated as equals. And all the CEOs are like, oh, this is perfect. Now we'll have two people working for the price of one.
Exactly.
So you saw their incomes decline, but mommy went to work. And mommy was now still able to pay the mortgage and the taxes and the car, because now her income combined with her husband's income, which was now half of what it was, they were able to sort of continue to sustain the family. The family didn't get healthier. They didn't get economically more stable. They just were able to replace the loss of the income of the spouse. I said,
I wanted to offer a little bit of an asterisk to that, because you're right. I think we're on the same macro analysis. In the 70s, we saw that wages started to decline or were flat.
Right.
And productivity went up because of technology. The application of technology, by the way, if we're keeping track, that the Pentagon developed with our tax dollars. And yet, people didn't participate in an increase in wealth. And at the same time, coincidentally, don't you know, labor movements took it on the chin.
Exactly.
Unions took it on the chin.
Exactly.
And we had Ronald Reagan lay off PATCO. But listen, they have compassion for us at the top of the pyramid, so they gave us household debt. They found ways we could borrow against our house that would have made our parents and grandparents
nauseous.
Think we were crazy. But
exactly.
They did it. So
exactly.
It's all built on household debt.
And I need to let you go, Bob, but okay. I'm going to end with my speech in the 1990s, where I talked about the fact that women entered the workforce and it stabilized the family. It didn't necessarily improve the economic status of the family, but by the 1990s, even with two incomes, you weren't stable. I said, so here's the deal. I want to start suggesting we have a ménage à trois. I said that that if we're going to go forward into the 2020s, we need to make sure that the family is now, you know, husband, husband, wife, wife, husband, whatever it is. But the ménage à trois, don't you love it?
It's a big love thing.
It is a big love thing.
America's family built to survive.
Exactly. And on that note, Bob.
Stuck Nation, by the way.
Bob Henley at StuckNation.com. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll talk to you in a couple of days. Ciao.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And we're going to end, everyone. I'm going to end with Aretha Franklin, because you know what? I want this conversation today to make you think. Change.